We get started. Thank you very much for coming. We want to thank, as we have this final installment here of the series, again, our meta celebrities, both Ellie Lasserman as well as Pam Lehman, involved in helping set up and facilitate this year. And as we always do, we thank our hosts, in particular here, Robbie and Libby Lehman, for opening up their beautiful home to us. Thank you very, very much. And here I am confident, as was the last week where I was only guessing, this week I've already confirmed that there are delicious baked goods waiting for you after this year. So no matter how well this year goes, for those of you who don't know, Libby is a legendary cook and baker, and it was worth it to come this year, at least for that. Everyone should have a source sheet. I'm sure I have enough, I hope, for everyone. And as you know, my style is very much source-based, so there's enough. Everyone should have their own source booklet, and I think there's some extras in the back. We have discussed a lot in the last 2 weeks. We're up to about 60 sources we've already covered. We have another almost 30 for tonight. And the truth is, as I'm sure you can imagine, we've left out enormous amounts. There's so much that we haven't covered. I was thinking that this could be a, kind of almost a semester type of a thing. And someone was mentioning to me just today as we walked to shul, it could at least be one more shiur. And I feel bad that sometimes, as much as I've not incorporated the amount that I've tried to incorporate, we've been a little bit rushed at times, although I've tried to hopefully balance that out. But I just wanted to give you a sense of as many issues as possible, especially some of the very basic fundamental issues we discussed the first week and last week as well, especially where we ventured into what I thought was fascinating territory as we discussed some, if you will, different models for potential analysis, both in terms of adoptive and step-parents, in-laws, grandparents, and that was really something I think was very interesting in its own right, and also because it shed light on underlying issues that relate to kibbutz av aim, even for biological parents who raise their children. It's an enormous mitzvah. We spent the first week discussing a sampling of some of the incredible Ma'amari Chazal that extol both the challenge and the demanding nature of the mitzvah, but how important and how beautiful it is. There's nothing more I can add to the beautiful words of Chazal that we mentioned in that first year. And it's been, I guess an honor, no pun intended, just to spend these 2 weeks myself studying and learning these halachos to prepare the shurim and to give them over. And I hope those of you who have been at the shurim have benefited from them. Thanks, as always, to Ellie. If you have missed any of the shurim or you just want to review, the audio as well as the PDF files of the source sheets are all available through the shul website, and you can certainly listen to those and download those at your convenience. One final word, which I guess more precisely I should have mentioned at the beginning of the first year, and that is that all of this learning and all of this teaching, certainly for me at least, has been in honor of my own parents. I'm very, very blessed. Someone actually mentioned it to me who knows my parents a little bit after the first year, how blessed I am. And for those of you who only know them a little bit, you only know a little bit of how blessed I am. The more you know my parents, the more you'd know how blessed I am to have such wonderful parents. And it's really been a pleasure to reinforce this and to contemplate it. There isn't a minute that goes by when I'm learning this sugya, where at least in some form of my subconsciousness, and very often it creeps into the consciousness, my consciousness, as to think about how fortunate I am and how much this relates to them. And I will be the first to admit how lacking I am at times in meeting the very, very high demands that our Chazal have for us. We saw one of the Mamre Chazal speak about, someone who was very proud of how much they had observed the mitzvah, and finding out that it was only 1/1000th of what we should have done, as Esav himself, and that Gemara was the embodiment, or the other Gemara where the mother, the classic Jewish mother, was being taking pride in her son, Rabbi Tarfon's fulfillment of Kibbutz av Aim, and the rabbis again saying, it's not even a fraction of what he should be doing. So this is an endless mitzvah. As much as we do for our parents, as much as we feel about them, we could all be doing more, myself included. And this learning, I hope, among other things, reminds us of that and re-energizes us to commit ourselves to this great mitzvah, kibbutz av aim. For tonight, I would like to jam-pack in a number of other topics, and while I'm going to mention it, I feel bad, it's kind of an appendage at the end, and it's a very sensitive topic that will deal only partially with what is otherwise a very large topic of dealing with elderly and infirm parents, and I have only one specific aspect of that for the end of this year, but it's a little bit related to the rest of this year. The primary theme of the first part of this year, most of what we'll do tonight, is some very fascinating issues, I believe, which all have the following common thread, and that is my introduction, notwithstanding the limits of kibbutz av aim. When it is that we may not have to, or perhaps not allowed, to listen to our parents. And I think that aside from, you know, the children, all of us is very excited for this topic. The parents and us, a little less. Nevertheless, it's important, just objectively because it's important, and it's also particularly important because some of the issues we'll see, it actually fleshes out one of a very fundamental issue about the definition of Kibbutz of Aim, both in terms of what it is and also what it is not. And I think it's a very, very important thing. I'm joking that it's obviously children want to hear that more. The truth is that any good parent should want to know that as well. The first issue I want to discuss, again, I'll probably mention this before we transition to the next topic, but just to reiterate, like almost all the things, especially this one, is incredibly complicated and incredibly sensitive, and no firm practical decisions or conclusions should be drawn from the little bit of a sampling. But I just want to, so to speak, give a sample of a few different topics tonight. The first one I want to discuss is whether there are financial obligations in keeping out the aim. Incredibly, I can't tell you how many machloksim have started over this. This can be incredibly sensitive. Especially when it has to do with the in-laws, which we saw last night is a mitzvah to be mechabed your in-laws, but it's still very, very sensitive. It can be sensitive if there are blended families. It can be sensitive even if everything is straight. You know, it's one thing to say, I love you, Mom. It's another thing to write out a check. That's human nature. And the Chazal were aware of the human nature and very much analyzed this question. So still some seats up front. It doesn't matter where I give the shiur, it doesn't matter the topic. The last seats to be filled are always the ones up front. There's one truism of life, and that is that those will be the last seats filled. Let's start with the opening source of Gemara and Masechta Kedushin, which specifically addresses this question. Rabbi, if I could ask you for a favor, just a cup of water. I'm feeling a little bit sore throated. Thank you. Okay. Iboilu, the Gemara itself asks this question very directly. Michel me. Kibbutz of Aim, who does that, where does the money come from? Who pays for it if it's something that costs money? Rav Yehuda Amar, Michel Ben. Children have to spend the money out of their own pocket in order to provide for the parents. Nosam bar Oshia Amar, Michel Av. So in the Gemara, we mentioned a few weeks ago, says that you have to feed your parents or clothe them. So it means is that if they can't, you have to go to the closet and bring the clothing or the food out of the closet or the refrigerator. And if he needs to go buy it at the grocery store, so you take their checkbook, you take their credit card, and you go to the grocery store. But not that you have to lay out the money yourself. That's the second opinion. And the first opinion says, when necessary, it does include, this mitzvah does include even spending money on your parents. The Gemara itself tries to bring a proof, and it suggests a certain source. Thank you. Gemara suggests a source for the mitzvah of Kibbutz of Aim, which would indicate that you do have to spend money on it. And the Gemara resolves that by saying, well, perhaps that source is not dispositive, perhaps that's not conclusive, because if you see on the last line here of this first source, the verse says, well, perhaps that can be referring to what's called bittul malacha. And that is that maybe even according to the opinion that says you don't have to spend money on your parents, you don't have to actually take money out of your pocket, but what if your mother has a 1 o'clock doctor's appointment? So you're going to have to take off work, and maybe you work by the hour. Or even if you don't work by the hour, it'll affect you other ways professionally. So even though you lose work time, potential earning power, that, the Gemara says, it seems according to everyone, if necessary, you would have to do. Because that's obviously more indirect than something as if asking you, so to speak, take money out of your pocket. That is the conclusion of the Gemara, that at the very least, everyone agrees, the bittul malacha, to miss work, to help your parents, that you have to do. But the more fundamental question of whether you actually have to take money out, to spend money on your parents, that is a machlokes in the Gemara, and it's not clear if there is a conclusion or a ruling in the Gemara. Now, there is a story, it's not an elaborate story, like there are many Kibbutz of Aim stories which are very colorful and vivid, as we've seen. This is a more succinct one-liner story, but if you look, to go back for a second, to the end of the top line of that source, the Gemara tells a story, Orule Rabbanan Rav Yirmiyah, that the Rabbanan, you know, so to speak, taught and transmitted to Rav Yirmiyah, Amrile Levrei to Rav Yirmiyah, or some say it was to his son, Kemand Amar Mishel Av. This story has it that at least one other rabbi who came later than the original argument, he did suggest that the position was that it comes out of the parents' pocket. But the Gemara itself, in a clear way, Hilchasakuh, that line you don't ever have in the Gemara. Despite the fact that it's a little bit vague, the Rishonim seem to be very clear on how to rule. If you take a look at the next source, number two, Tosfos themselves, as well as in the name of other authorities, rule that you see from this story, even though it's not such a long and involved story, but the very fact that the Gemara has that extra layer where it says that at least one subsequent rabbi said that the halacha is that the parents have to spend their own money. So Tosfos says, you see from this, mashma, shakacha halacha. The fact that the Gemara added that layer, even if it was only a small one-liner, but since we have no other evidence to point us in one firm direction or the other, Tosfos assumed that itself is a proof, and in fact quotes other authorities who say that way as well. Take a look on the second line. They mentioned something that's very important. So if we would stop here, though, let's stop here for a second. Right now, it seems to be, and this is in fact is the ruling in the Shulchan Aruch. If you take a look at source number 5, just for a moment, the beginning of the source, it says, "Zesh ma'achilo umashkehu," that which we say that you have to feed and drink and give to drink and to clothe your parents. Mishel av ve'aim, it's supposed to come from your parents. If they have the money, so then you take their money if necessary and spend it on them if they can't otherwise do it. Now that is true in the ideal case. Ideal case meaning that your parents can afford whatever the necessities are. Why are they asking you to do it? Well, either because they have three other children who they're taking care of, even if they're young, but maybe they have four other kids, so you're dealing with the oldest child, you go run off to the grocery store, get me something. Or it could be that they're already elder and infirm, and maybe they have the money. Many an aged parent has given over their checkbook, and hopefully the keys as well, if that becomes necessary. I had it just in my family, and Baruch Hashem, it went smoother than sometimes it goes in other families, but we had to take away the keys from my grandmother. But certainly a checkbook and having the ability to write checks and manage the money. So that is obviously a very common stage of life. The children who themselves may be middle-aged or older find themselves if they're blessed with even elderly parents. So there you have, it's the parents' money. This is the ideal, simple case. They can afford it. It's just that for whatever reason they need you to actually take care of things for them. So the halacha is their money, that's fine. And that's, again, certainly the children and all of us can easily accept that. However, it's not so simple. Why is it not so simple? And this is before debates over Social Security. But in general, on the contrary, now it's much better. Even someone who wasn't necessarily wealthy in their lifetime, but can have at least some baseline with Social Security or some form thereof. Obviously, for much of human history, there was nothing like that. So as long as you can work on the farm or work wherever you could work, you've made a living. But when you got older, what did you do? You moved, exactly, right? The family farm, or you moved in with the kids, right? So what if all of a sudden a parent child says, listen, I love my dad, I love my mom, but all of a sudden they want to move in with me? You know how much that's going to cost me extra food? I'm supposed to pay for them? You know, I'll buy them clothes. They don't have money? Okay, let them go to collect tzedakah. What does that have to come off me? Doesn't the Gemara say that it comes from the parents, not from the children? So this, again, from the Gemara itself, you won't have a real indication of how to resolve such a potentially tension-filled or explosive situation. However, the Rishonim already anticipate this issue, and they address it head-on, and seem to be very, very adamant what the responsibilities are. If you go back to the second source, Tosfos, in that second line, they mention as follows. After they've already said that really the money is only supposed to come from the parent, and they add, "Upasak heichad lesle la'av v'isle leven." What if the father, the mother, obviously it doesn't matter here, being gender neutral, has no more money, they can't afford it, but the children, thankfully, are in a position of more financial independence. Chayiv haben lezun aviv. Then the children are considered responsible. As you don't just throw them off to the community. If you can't, you can't. But the first order of business is, in theory, if they can, for the children to take care of their parents.
This is assuming a single male son.
Not assuming anything. We haven't made anything more specific than, we haven't assumed anything. We just,
because then there's a question of allocation of responsibility across children.
You mean if there's multiple children? We'll get there. But that, Tosfos doesn't talk about that yet. So don't make any assumptions. Tosfos didn't say anything yet. Tosfos just said if the parent can't afford, the children are expected to step up. The Ritva here, we don't have to see it inside explicitly, but the Ritva seems to say this as well. And what is implied, perhaps in earlier sources, however, is more specifically addressed in source number 4. And that is the following question. And again, I don't want to get too academic for the purposes of this year, but I think it is interesting and perhaps may even have some practical implications, which is the fact that we say that in certain specific situations there is a financial obligation on the children, which we've now said, when the parents simply can't afford it. So we have to ask ourselves, what generates that obligation? What mitzvah
box, if you will. If I want to, you know, this is, you know, cliche, but, you know, Rabbi, you know, Rabbi, who said, where does it say? What mitzvah makes me do this? You know, come on, Rabbi, tell me, Rabbi. I'm not going to be able to speak that way, right? But every other Jew in the world does, so, especially if it has to do with money. Who said, Rabbi? So, which mitzvah would I tell them? Would I tell them that kibbut abayim means you have to spend money? That's possible. Although, then again, without getting too fine, on the one hand, didn't the Gemara, didn't the Rishonim just say that the halacha of kibbut abayim is only from the parents? So it's only from the parents, but with an exception? That's a possibility. What's an alternative possibility?
Tzedakah.
Excellent. Right? We all have a mitzvah to give tzedakah. And where does charity start? Right? Before you run off giving to the kollel in Washington and the kollel in wherever and to the soup kitchen in Russia and to the soup kitchen in Eretz Israel. If you have parents who are in need, it doesn't have to necessarily be indigent or, God forbid, welfare, just the basic, whatever need they have. If they can't afford it, so who should you give it from? Now, this could have a very, again, it may sound like a theoretical, and again, it is a lumdusha discussion, you know, which mitzvah generates the obligation? But there are a number of possible nafkaminas, practical, you know, differences. One very basic one would be, if we consider that we have a certain amount of money to allocate each year to tzedakah, so does this money come off the top of that? Which is another way of saying, when the mikvah comes knocking, when the day school comes knocking, can you say, listen, I already had to spend $5,000 on my mother this year, so therefore I have less to give from the tzedakah account that I can give you, but I can't give you the usual $100, I can only give you $36 this year. Is that legitimate or not? That's it. We're no longer in the theoretical world.
More expensive because it's not deductible.
Okay. You write the checks to your grandma, to your mother for the shul. We'll only take 10%. So do you have to do that? Right. So that's a very basic question. Even if we're saying that when it's necessary, your parent has to, the child has to step up to the plate, but what mitzvah obligates us? And, again, just to, without getting, I hope this to discuss perhaps a less pleasant situation, let's say the child refuses. That's what the child refuses. I don't care. I'll let my, you know, let him eat cake. You know, he never let me as a child, and I, for years of therapy, I still don't feel better about that. Let him eat cake. I'm not helping them. Right? So, again, not that we don't necessarily have those capabilities, but in theory, in an autonomous Jewish community, where there was a concept of kfiyah, there were times if a person wasn't doing a mitzvah, the Beis Din didn't just look at it as, you know, our more Western mindset is religion is a private thing. You know, I do, I don't do. But it's classically Jewish communities, not true. We very often would step in and force people to keep up certain standard behavioral obligations, especially if they relate to other people. So would Beis Din come in and force the person to do it? If it's a keep it out of aim, it's a little less likely. But tzedakah, the halach is that we are kofin on tzedakah. Someone doesn't fulfill tzedakah obligations. You don't play that you don't go to the shul dinner. You know, it's not just an annoying phone call. You know, please, come on. It's not just guilt. We could give a slop. That was in the olden days. So would you do that if someone was refusing to treat their parents as well? So it's a very interesting question. So from some of the sources we've seen until now, it's not as obvious one way or the other, although they seem to be a little bit implied. But source number four is Rabbeinu Asher. Rabbeinu Asher was one of the great, great Rishonim, and of course he's also most important halachically because his life story bridged Ashkenaz and Sfarad. He ran away from the Crusades, from Ashkenaz to Sfarad, and even though many other Rishonim were either more in one or the other, Spain, Germany, Italy, wherever they were, because of his broad life story, so in fact, aside from having a fascinating biography, but in his halacha, he actually is very often a hybrid and will quote the different menachim. So he's a very, very important, he has been historically a very, very important source. So it's interestingly, when he quotes this halacha, he also agrees with the Tosfos. If you take a look just at the part that I have underlined, after he has said that it's really the parent's responsibility financially, but he then says, V'hecha, the revicha haben, the son, thankfully, Kenayin Ara, has a nice full bank account, ha'av lesle, but the father, Nebuchadnezzar, already doesn't have any money, kaifinan le leben. He says, we as a Beis Din, as a community, would force the child, b'shaklinan meinei, b'toras tzedakah, b'yavinan lavua. That when the child has and the parent doesn't, then the child has to support the parent as part of his or her tzedakah obligations. Now again, from a conceptual perspective, it's fascinating. You see from this that he's still not willing to give in. Kibbut av'eim never applies to money. Didn't he just say that the child has to pay? Yeah, but that's not kibbut av'eim. That's called tzedakah, but prioritizing your own parents above, obviously, complete strangers. As much as you may want to help them, your parents come first. And again, it has a significant benefit, if you will, in the sense that at least that way, from a technical perspective, you can, if you will, deduct that. If it doesn't work for taxes, I don't know. But you can deduct it from your tzedakah obligations and otherwise money that you would think that you would owe. And in fact, this seems to be how it's quoted in Halacha. If you take a look at verse number 5, again, back to the Shulchan Aruch. So he says, Mishal av aim, it's really supposed to be the parents' money, im yeshlo, if they have, vim aim la'av, the yeshlo ben, if again, if the father doesn't have and the child has money, kofin oso, you force the child, v'zon aviv kefima shehu yachol. You force the child to pay for what he can and to support his father. Now, a trickier question comes into what if the children aren't exactly rolling in it, and let's say they're on a very, very tight budget as well, and all of a sudden they have, you know, this whole other head to feed, and perhaps with medical expenses and other things, you know, what do you do then? So for the sake of time, I don't want to go into it now, but just to, other than to say that if you take a look at the continuation of the Shulchan Aruch and the other sources, they discuss whether a child would have to go on the dole, would a child have to collect tzedakah so that he can also afford to pay for his parents, or perhaps that much it wouldn't go. What if a child has to miss work to do order to help his parents? All sorts of things are, again, there are, in this case, pardon the expression, but there is really a lot of devil in the details. But the principle, which is certainly an important one, is that from a technical perspective, kibud av aim is not meant to be a financial obligation. It's meant to be either behavioral or attitudinal, but not financial. Nevertheless, there are times where kibud av aim is not the only value. There's another thing called tzedakah. And again, there is a general notion in tzedakah that, you know, ani yircha kodem, you're supposed to support your community first, and you're obviously supposed to support your family even before your community. Just in response to something which is often an issue and sometimes is the source of strife in families, and something that Ellie already alluded to, which is what if you have multiple children? Right, so each one is looking as fast as they can to the brother, to the sister. So in fact, if you take a look at the Ramah here in source number 5, he does allude to this. I have it underlined. He says, im yesh lo banim rabim, what if there's more than one child, multiple children? It's interesting. He does not say that you divide it equally. After $10,000 of expenses for the parents and there's four children, he does not say you just assume it's $2,500 across the board. He says it depends on who, not all the children. One child's learning at Kolo, the other child's a very famous doctor, and the other child's a truck driver. You know, you have to see who has how much money. And then, appropriately, each one does whatever they can, and hopefully, obviously, that's enough. So there are times where, again, this can be very delicate. I have witnessed both sources of fights. I witnessed where no one wants to take up the obligation, and that has bred resentment or fighting. And I have other times where the fighting is because, no, I want her to live with me. Mom's going to live with me. I'm going to take care of Mom. No, you don't. And then I can complain that you don't do enough because only I want. Right? So family dynamics can sometimes be complicated, and hopefully the key to having a good resolution of these complicated situations is to have as good a relationship beforehand as possible. It's not a guarantee, but the more likely, the better the relationship between the parents and the siblings is ahead of time, the more likely when push comes to shove, it'll be handled the right way. That's not a guarantee. I've seen it not work even then too, but these are certainly delicate situations, and if you can't avoid them with prevention, then hopefully, whether it's with the rabbi or whoever else, somehow they can be resolved less painfully than they would otherwise. I'm going to skip source number 6, even though it relates, at least on the surface, to this topic. But it really brings out an issue which is going to be relevant for us in the next area. Just so you should know, because it's a fascinating topic, he discusses the following case here in source number 6, which is sometimes if you have attention, which is he's discussing according to the opinion that says it's an obligation that I have to pay out of my own money. So he says, what if at the same time I have that obligation, let's say I have a lost object? Which comes first? Am I looking for my own lost object or going to buy my dad dinner? And what if this guy's really hit the lottery, and not only is he looking for his own lost object, but he also found someone else's lost object? See, it's three balls. He's trying to juggle three mitzvahs. Keep it up, aim to take care of his parents, according to the opinion that says it's a financial obligation, looking for his own aveda, and try to return someone else's aveda. What comes first? If it so happens, he paskins that in that case you have a right to be selfish. You are supposed to look for your own aveda, your own obligation first, even according to the opinion that says you generally are supposed to spend money on your parents. Why he has that very fascinating psak relates to a topic which we'll get to, which is, maybe the most important sub-issue or subtle point from the whole shir. Let's, however, now take a break from this and move on to another topic. And this also has the potential, and I witnessed it, I'm sure some of you even had experiences this, unfortunately, can be If there are insensitive parents, and sometimes there are insensitive parents, and can be if there are insensitive children, and there are plenty of insensitive children, the source of great problem, which is when you have religious debates. Boy goes to yeshiva, girl goes to seminary, boy goes to NCSY. I mean, the possible variables of this case are innumerable. Bottom line, what do you do when potentially kibud av ha'eim conflicts with, from the child's perspective, mitzvah observance? Now again, there are unlimited number of cases. You know, you come home and you don't think your parents told the dishes. Your parents hold up one level of kashrus but not another. You know, just apply to we're going to be just talking primarily, at least for now, in general terms, and if there are any specifics, that'll have to be a private child another time. We would never finish or move on to anything if we started trying to get into all of the specifics. But you can only imagine. Some of you don't need an imagination because you've lived through this, and certainly if you have an imagination, you don't need a great one to imagine all of the potential issues that could come up in this category. So what do you do? How do you resolve that? So source number 7 really addresses this directly. It's also a medrash, and many know it because it's already a Rashi. It's quoted by Rashi on Chumash. Rabbis teach, Tana Rabbanan, Menayin Shim Omerlo Aviv, Hitameh, Osh Omerlo Al Tachzir. What happens if you have the Cohen family, and the father wants his son to go into a graveyard to become Tamei, which of course otherwise a Cohen is not allowed to do. Keep it up, aim, you have to listen to me. What if they're walking home, and the boy finds someone's wallet? So he says, wow, I can fulfill a mitzvah from the Torah of Hashavas Aveda. But the father's understood, he wants to get home. And he says, no, leave it there. Don't return it. Also, he's telling, Lo Sucha Lesalim, it's a pasuk in Chumash. You're not allowed to turn away your eyes or close your eyes if you see someone's lost object. So you have
is
a kazu.
Shabbos or not Shabbos?
Not Shabbos. But it would be the same thing. It would be the same thing if the dad said, make me an egg, and it's Shabbos, and you can't do that on Shabbos. These are just two examples that the Gemara talks about. You have a direct conflict between a prohibition in the Torah and kibud av ha'eim. Also, mitzvah of the Torah. What do you do? The Gemara says, in this case, quite simply, God wins. Parents lose. There's a limitation on parental power, parental obligations. How do we know that? So the Gemara says from the Pasuk, which is the source of Mora, which we talked about a lot in the first week of this year, Ish imo v'aviv tiro, we're supposed to fear our mother and our father. How does the Pasuk conclude? Es shabso sai tish moro, which is really a non sequitur. What does the one have to do with the other? Keeping Shabbos and fearing your parents. So says the Gemara, God put that in the Torah for a reason, so that we would realize it for this. It's coming to teach you, kulchem chayavin b'chvodi, that you and your parents are all answering, how did it go? To a higher authority. Right? Was it Hebrew National? Right? We all answered, and this is, we answered a higher authority, even the Hebrew National. Right, that would be a shiloh. If your parents want you to eat Hebrew National francs. Okay. So in that case, says the Gemara, parents are asking you to violate Hashem's covenant. Keep it of aim is wonderful, but covenant for Hashem is more important. And therefore, if it's such, again, this is an easy case. Right? Real life is usually not this simple. But this is an easy case where it's a direct violation or your parents, so your parents have to take a back seat. It's interesting that the Gemara says that you needed a pasuk to teach us this. Shouldn't it have been obvious? And again, I don't want to get into the details. The Gemara has a technical argument why it should be obvious, because there's only one mitzvah of listening to your parents, but on these types of things, let's say for Shabbos or other things, there's two mitzvahs of losa said. There's a technical reason why, but the Gemara, bottom line, asks, why do we need this pasuk? It should have been obvious. And the Gemara answers by relating to something we discussed 2 weeks ago in our first year, that because kibud av ha'eim is compared to the general love and honor that we have to Hashem, we saw this in the first week, that in a certain sense, kibud av ha'eim is actually a mitzvah of ben adam l'makom. It's part of a relationship with Hashem that relates to our parents. There are many representations of what it means to be a creator. They gave us life, as God gives us all life. So because of that, says the Gemara, I might have thought, because there's so much embodied in my honoring of my parents, maybe that would even have overruled the Torah. It's unbelievably illustrative of how powerful kibud av ha'eim is supposed to be. Says the Gemara, we would have thought, perhaps, that you violate the Torah for your parents. But no, bottom line, Kamash Mulan, the fact is we have this pasuk that teaches us Shabbos Tishmoro. It never works out that way. Now, the Gemara here gave us two very easy examples, not only because they're cut and dry, but also because they're Torah prohibitions, they're mitzvahs d'oraisa. What if you have kibud av ha'eim, which is a Torah obligation, d'oraisa, and a mitzvah min rabbanon, only rabbinic, to take a very obvious or famous one, what if their parents say, we're not lighting Hanukkah candles tonight? Come with me, we're all going out to dinner, there's not going to be Hanukkah candles tonight. And Hanukkah is wonderful, but it's only a rabbinic mitzvah. Parents, that's a Torah mitzvah. So often when we have a Torah mitzvah versus a rabbinic mitzvah, Torah wins out. So this is, again, not addressed explicitly in the Gemara, but the Rambam does rule very clearly in source number 8, not only is it true about an asei and a los asei, afilu shel divrehem, even if it's only a rabbinic mitzvah, nevertheless, you're still obligated, and it still trumps your parental responsibility, your responsibility towards your parents. There's a discussion about minhagim, based on the very famous Tshuva L'Chasam Sofer. What about a midas chasidus? How far do you push it? So it could be maybe a midas chasidus, not. I believe I read in a recent article that there was a shah, they asked Rav Scheinberg, that there was a son who came home from yeshiva and he was shuckling like crazy in shul, and it embarrassed the father. So he wasn't, so the father was saying, don't daven, but you have to be so fill in the blank. And Rav Scheinberg said, in this case, the son should listen to the father. To not daven or something like that would be, of course, then that comes before the parents. But here, if it's just a nice midas chasidus, you know, shuckle a little bit. You know, other ways to have kavana. You don't have to create such a show if it's making your parents uncomfortable. So that was an example where perhaps keeping up the aim would win out. But short of something like that, it seems like the rabbanon, even minhagim perhaps, if they're real, but again, you have to know what's a real minhag and what's a made-up, you know, thing which 30 years ago no one heard of. You know, they have to know what's, every case has to be handled on its own. But in theory, even things which are otherwise not as cogent or powerful as Kibbutz of Aim, they would win. And the reason seems to be very simple, and that it's not a question of technical sourcing. Is it Torah obligation, rabbinic obligation? What this source, is, this principle is teaching us, is that Kibbutz of Aim is not supposed to come in between your relationship with Hashem.
How about if it's a minhag of the Av, and the child goes off to yeshiva and comes home with a different question.
Very good, very good. That may not be right for two reasons. One, because it distresses the father, but also because independently the son may really be obligated in that midhag as a member of the family. So that may be itself. Yet again, every case has to be understood on its own, but yes, in theory that might be wrong. Yeah, I can tell you as someone who has not long, you know, since been in yeshiva, yeshivas do many things well. Most don't do this well. Most yeshivas are busy, and again, in the best sense of the word, getting our children as committed as possible without always worrying about how that's going to relate to when they get home. Not all, and I actually went to one of the yeshivas that tried to deal with that preemptively and talk about being respectful to parents and accommodating, but it's a problem. It's a problem that hopefully the more sense the child has, the less likely it is, but it certainly can be a problem. And again, the best way to resolve those, especially if you have such a child, is to take them to the rabbi. And even if they may not listen to the parent, if the rabbi doesn't listen to the parent, sometimes that works. I know that, even forget this type of a conflict, just in general, you know, if a child is doing well in school, especially young children, but I guess it's probably true for little children, right, the last person that's important is parents. Right? This is true, right? I have a first grade son. It doesn't matter what I would say. If Rebbe says it, so if there's anything I really want, I call the Rebbe. Could you tell Yaakov that he'll do it? Because Rebbe said it. So, you know, that's sometimes the case. Sometimes you have to just know how to play the psychology game. Yeah.
I want to ask the question that you asked before. Rabbi, where do you see that not shuffling is part of Kibbutz of Aim? In other words, that just because if the parent says it is...
So we're going to get to the issue which you're relating to, which is what right does the parent have to tell the child not to? We'll get to that, but for now, the principle which I'm enunciating, you'll see where this comes into play in a little bit, is that if you're upsetting the parents, so again, it depends on what's upsetting them. If keeping kosher upsets them, which could happen, that wasn't a made-up story. That's very real. So that's, you try to be sensitive as much as you can, and the rabbi or somebody might give you 10 different ways to say it to them, and it's nice, and it's this, but at the end of the day, that's going to be too bad on the parents. The point of Schreiber is here, what you're gaining... In that case, does not legitimate what you're losing or the pain you're causing. It depends on what it is. That's why I gave that as an extreme example in that in that direction. I want to give you two other examples that illustrate this point in a very beautiful way. First of all, you should realize, I hope this is obvious and this is dramatized by a beautiful source, but till now all the mitzvahs we've seen or discussed are about my relationship with Hashem, which makes sense. Hashem shosai tishmaru, your parents can't get in the way of your relationship with Hashem. Let's remember, we have a holistic view of religious life. It's not just about your relationship with God, it's also about your interpersonal relationships. So what if your parents want to get in the middle of Benan Machavero? So a very beautiful, fascinating tshuva by the Rosh in Siman 10, going back to our friend the Rosh. He had the following case. Again, you can't, truth is always more fascinating than fiction. There was a father, who had, there was some kind of a fight, and this, you know, family, you know, the Hatfield and the McCoys, and Junior Hatfield wanted to make up with the McCoys. And the father is trying to make a promise. You cannot talk to them. We hate them, and we're going to stay in a machlekes, and I don't want to make shalom. And the father is saying, kibud av v'aim, you have to listen to me. You would be disloyal to me. You'd be stabbing me in the back if you make shalom with them. Don't want you talking to them. So they ask the Rosh, what do you do? And he says, to hate another Jew is usser. The father himself, being machzik machlokes, he's perpetuating machlokes, sinaschinum, the father is in an avera, and he has no right to make his child do it. If the child wants to do the mitzvah, the right thing to do is to make shalom. The father has no right. Same halacha, as achosai tishmoru, it's not just in the narrow sense about honoring God, it's about our general religious life. If we want to have growth and positive religious direction, which in this case, interpersonally it is, the parents have no right to interfere. Another example, which is very interesting, and also shows you the different contours and parameters of this, is in source number 11, is from the famous sefer Chavetz Chaim, hence the name, the Chavetz Chaim, from the book Chavetz Chaim. Right, we have this custom, I've mentioned this in the past in Judaism, where we name people after books. So the Mishnah Brura wrote the Chavetz Chaim. There was a very famous, I think I may have mentioned to you, there was a very famous Jewish studies professor who wrote many books, and his most well-known one was called the Shabbos Guy. And he used to lament to his students that he knew that after 120 they're going to call me the Shabbos guy. I don't know if it exactly happened that way, but it makes for a good story. But it was worth, in Judaism, yeah, that you have what to fear. We do that. So the Chavetz Chaim is discussing the following. Chavetz Chaim here is just as a background. He's talking about the fact that, you know, if you tell a story, right, I'm just telling someone a story. You know, we think sometimes Lashon Hara is I'm looking to gossip about the person. I'm looking to talk bad about them. That is Lashon Hara, but it's not limited to that. Unless you're just telling a story, but it includes talking about other people. So Chavetz Chaim, he's at the point now where he's trying to demonstrate that those are examples of Lashon Hara as well. And he mentions that what if your parents ask you to tell them a story? They ask you to tell a story which in any other context would be a Lashon Hara story. But mom asked me. Keep it up, aim. So he points out here, in such a case, since part of the story will include Lashon Hara, it's prohibited, even though the parent asked. So on the one hand, it's just another example of a Benam Chavero, which does not come in, which is supersedes Kibud Avaim. But the Chavetz Chaim points out, he wrote his own footnotes in this case, in the little footnote there below, footnote number 9, he says, Lo taisi bipshitus kegon impikshu mimenu Lashon Hara gufa. He says, I wasn't talking about where the parents said, tell me Lashon Hara. He says, because then, I guess he was talking about tzaddikim. He says, that's an unlikely case. He says, I'm talking about something more indirect. Parents say, tell me something which is otherwise okay, but the child, the one who's going to tell the story, knows that it will include something that incidentally is prohibited. Even in that, says the Chavetz Chaim, Kibud Av Aim does not trump. Whereas you might think if it's a direct head-on collision, Avera, Kibud Av Aim, so the Avera always supersedes, meaning don't do the Avera. But what if it's more indirect? You might have thought, I'm only indirectly going to commit an Avera, but I'm directly fulfilling Kibud Av Aim. So the first time, even that. Anything that gets in the way, even indirectly, even incidentally, with your hopefully positive religious growth and direction, always comes before Kibud Av Aim. Now again, how you tell a parent, how you avoid situations when there's the conflict. So that all gets into not only common sense, but that's halachos as well. This is not our topic. I'm not mentioning this specifically, but as you may know, there's a whole other flip, the cousin of this topic, is what if you see your parents do something wrong? And the halacha is very clear that you're not just supposed to correct them, and you're certainly not supposed to make fun of them and make them feel bad, even as you tell them, which you should, for their own benefit, you have to be very respectful and do it in a kind of a roundabout, sensitive way. So that's true even if you're trying to explain to them why you can't tell them a story or why you want to daven in a different shul, which we'll see that shortly. Yeah, again, I hope nothing I'm saying is taken in isolation or in a vacuum or simplistically. Obviously, even as we speak about the limits, which is the basic theme of this year, the limits are only for what they're said, but that doesn't excuse you from anything else. And even as you maybe employ the limits, it always has to be done with as deft a touch and as sensitively as possible. Let's take a look at the next source. The next source is a classic, very famous discussion, and it is a very, very practical question, I have to say. And this is the issue of marriage. Keep it up, aim. Okay, I gathered by the laugh. I didn't pick a topic that was irrelevant. What if the parents don't like who you want to marry? Now, this just as an aside, it indicates that the parents weren't making the decision. This is an aside, just as a historical note. If you have tshuvas going back over 500 years in Italy, for example, as we'll see in a second, where the child's getting married and the parent says, no, I don't want you to marry that one. So apparently it wasn't as simple as the parents just coming home and saying, this is who you're marrying. Because the child, in this case, was already in love with somebody. It's just that the parents were stepping in and saying, I don't want you to marry. And why does it always seem to be this way in the stories? That girl. This is a coincidence, I guess. It always seems to be that they're overprotective mother and doesn't like that girl. Obviously, it could have no direction, but it just seems to me. More often than not, the stories are in one direction. So this is a ruling of the Ramah. The Ramah quotes the Shulchan Aruch, and I quote it for you because it's so beautiful and so important. The source underneath it, source 13. The ruling of the Ramah, which is based on Rav Yitzchak Kolon, who was about 500 years ago, lived in Italy, one of the later Rishonim. So he writes the Ramah based on the conclusion of the Ma'arik, that parents have no right, I repeat, no right to interfere with the ultimate life choice of a child. If a child wants to marry a boy or a girl, parents ultimately, and again, this is a lot more complicated in actual life, but I'm aware, trust me, I'm aware. I've been involved, so I know. Not with my own marriage, Moshe. I've said before, and I'll say again, and if you know my parents can have them, they know it's true. If they had to choose, my parents would keep my wife well before me. So they love her tremendously. It's the best thing I ever did for that, from their perspective, as you, I'm sure, would all agree. So I know, but the bottom line is, leave aside the fact that it can sometimes be more complicated, but for the sake of the sheer now, we're not discussing the kind of complicated application of this, but just the principles behind it. So I want to read for you a few of the parts of the original source. This is source number 13, which is that tshuva of the Ma'arik, where he was asked this question. Asher nistapakta, you were wondering, im yesh koach b'yad ha'av limchos b'yad b'no, lisa isha, asher yachkot b'ah ha'ben, can the father prevent his son from marrying a certain girl? So he says, Nira, shim hi isha hu genes lo, and of course that's a little bit of the detail here, which we will not be able to flesh out. If it's an appropriate girl, you know, now who determines? That's obviously not so simple, I understand that. She'ein ko'ach b'yad ha'av l'mchos b'yad ha'ben. Says the Ma'arik, the father, the mother, cannot stop the child from marrying. So he mentions one point right at the beginning, which I don't want to dwell on, because he really gets into, he has two main points. And this is what I want to stress to you. You really only see this if you read the original source, not if you just see the Ramah citation. He has two different arguments, which are both fascinating and really unique and stand on their own. The first thing he says is, Hacha, shehu davar hashayach b'tzarei degufa. You're causing pain to the child. He speaks very romantically. For him to walk away from, to leave the woman that he loves, he's going to have to marry another woman, and he's not necessarily going to be so ay-ay-ay about this new girl. Karov hadover, last line, be'enai, lios kemitzva, excuse me, la'av world divrei Torah. The first thing Ma'arik says with such brilliant Talmudic creativity, this is an example of our last topic. Making your child marry someone they don't want to is an example of forcing them to transgress the Torah. As he alludes, getting married, creating a family, this is a mitzvah. And as we know, when he fleshes out, obviously love is an essential part of that discussion, not only ultimately in the marriage, but even choosing. We know the halacha is, there has to be a certain level of comfort and attraction between the couple if they're not allowed to get married. You're supposed to see, blind the Shaduchim are against the Torah. You have to, it's not just to see, it's to see, hopefully, to be interested and to be attracted. That presupposes, says the Ma'arik, that obviously you don't get married to someone you don't want to. We understand this is not a mechanical mitzvah like shaking a lulav. And therefore, to prevent it, to get in the way of who a child wants to marry, is essentially, and this is, I can easily see someone having argued with that. There's no question this is a jump, but that's why it's so powerful. So important to know, he makes the jump. He says that is tantamount to asking him to violate a mitzvah. So on the one hand, it's very, very creative and a big jump. On the other hand, in a certain sense, it's very conservative in that he's just relying on previously known categories. It's a creative application of a category, but he's not making anything new. This is just a new, perhaps unexpected application of the principle which we've already seen, which is that if you get involved, your parents try to get involved and complicate something that's the, quote, right thing for the child to do, and in this case, marrying the one that you want to marry is the right thing to do religiously, so then that would be, in a sense, tantamount to violating halacha. Yes?
It seems to me that, I don't know, maybe he's not alluding to this, but maybe he is. When he says karov hadavar, then maybe he's saying it's karov to al kenyado ishas aviv imo.
It does relate to that too, of course. But again, the point he's really making here, as you, if you turn over the page, he says, you see here, I paraphrase it, but if you take a look on the first two lines of the next page, that the halacha is you're supposed to marry someone who you desire. That's part of the halacha of marriage. Again, the way in one community they date and the way in other communities they have courtships obviously are very different. But hopefully, whatever the communal norms are and whatever the expectations are, and obviously, happiness and expectations are directly connected. There are certain types of marriages which you or I might be miserable in, but the people who had expectations for that are very happy with, and obviously vice versa. So each community perhaps has their own way of fulfilling this. But there is a constant, which is that you're supposed to be in love with your spouse. And obviously, in a good marriage, that love will be much deeper years later than it was the night you got married. But still, even before you get married, when you walk to that chuppah, there's supposed to be a certain... It's not supposed to be a stranger to you. It's supposed to be someone who you're excited and want to marry. And for the parents that make the child marry someone else, that would be a violation of this religious norm. That's the first argument he uses. The second argument he uses is actually a whole new principle. A principle new to us. We haven't seen it before. And it will flesh out a very salient point, which really gets to the heart of what is Kibbutz Av Ve'Em, and more importantly, what Kibbutz Av Ve'Em is not. If you were looking to hang a pasuk on it, that would be that. Good, very good. So the father will say, well, that's what my parents did to me. Right? I'll do something to you. But it wouldn't be an excuse. It would not be an excuse. Okay. Take a look in the middle of the third line. Until now, he says, we had an argument, how much does a child have to give up? Right? Do they have to give up money? Don't they have to give up money? But he says, even that machlokas, even someone who says the child has to give up money, that's only referring to bedavar, next line, fourth line, the shayech ha'av begava, something that relates to the needs of the father. Parnasas ha'av, shetzorach guf ha'av bekiyumo, things that are actual benefits for the father or the mother. So there's where there's a question, does the child have to give up of their own to do it, or just have to use the parents' money, let's say. But it's limited, even then, to things that are actual benefits and needs of the parent. But something like this, he's making a very profound statement, which is not shayach to the parent. It's not their life. It's the child's life. Who the child marries or not marries is not apparently considered a basic benefit or need of a parent. And therefore, it's one thing, they need to eat, they need to drink, so those are the things that you have to do for your parent, and perhaps according to at least one opinion, we don't even possibly like that opinion, but according to one opinion, you may even have to do that out of your own pocket. But that's for things that are directly beneficial to them. But things which are indirectly, I'm not saying the parent doesn't care, of course the parent cares, but that's not considered one of their needs. In such a case, pshita, it's obvious. Ein koach la'av limchos b'ben. The parent has no right to rule the child's life. Lo mishum kavod, lo mishum bora. And he points out, again, for the sake of time, I'm not going to be able to do it inside with you, but this is already said by earlier Rishonim. Source 15, the Ritz of Yavamos, as well as the last source on the first sheet, which we didn't read at the time, the Tosos, so source number 6, both already make this point. That whatever Kibbutz Av Ve'Em is, it relates to actual needs and benefits to the parent. But things that are incidental or indirect, or in this case, about the child's life, as much as that I'm talking about in the best, most sincere, wonderful, loving parent, they really make care and really love, but it's not their life. It's not their body. It's the child's life. And therefore, it's, just to put it in maybe more concise terms, just to show you why these are two very different arguments that he's employing. The first argument is saying, theoretically, Kibbutz Av Ve'Em would apply to such a question of who you marry and who you don't marry. It's just that in this case it doesn't, but Kibbutz Avayim is always trumped if it's in violation of a mitzvah. And as we've mentioned, he has this creative understanding that telling you to marry someone you don't want would be a violation of a mitzvah. But in theory, that argument is at least acknowledging that there's what to talk about. Kibbutz Avayim is relevant to the discussion. His second argument is actually much more fundamental and much more profound. Kibbutz Avayim is not even a relevant category. The parents don't even have a leg to stand on, because Kibbutz Avayim does not apply to everything. Kibbutz Avayim is about the parents' needs and the child's obligation to facilitate, to provide, to honor those needs. But when it comes to a child's life, that's his life. That's her life. And therefore, says the Ma'arik, and the Ramah quotes us in Shulchan Aruch, there are limits, obviously in this case, very severe limits, on what the parent can and can't do. Just so you should mention, I'm going to take that. Give me 1 second. Let me just make a few more points, and then I'll get to you. Source number 14 is the Rashba, a more well-known Rishon. The Rashba also has a similar case where he paskins that a parent cannot interfere when it comes to a marriage choice, and he just gives the first reason, that that's a violation of halacha. The other sources I had there, like in source 15, they're not discussing marriage, but they already are enunciating this principle that there are limits to what Kibbutz Avayim relates to. It does not relate to things that are not specifically about them. And here I want to flesh out the basic point, and then I'll take your questions. And also, just so you should know, that we still have two more sources on this topic, 16 and 17, which are perhaps a little bit more pro-parent, if you will. Maybe that's what you want to get to. Your children are married already, Marcel. Okay. Honestly, I got the most to lose here. Okay. The basic point which comes out of this, and this is how it's articulated by some of the more recent Svarim, is basically the following question. Is authority part of the mitzvah Kibbutz Avayim? Take an extreme case. What do sometimes parents do when their back is against the wall and the child is saying, but why, but why, but why? Is that a legitimate halachic statement? That's the question. I'm being very serious with you, as a parent who sometimes stumbles on that myself. I certainly heard it more than once in my life as a child.
Certainly not if another mitzvah is involved. You're talking about...
Right, even without that. Even without that. In other words, again, sometimes we say that as parents, because it's really a very good reason, just the child either can't because of their age or because they don't want to understand it. But let's say there wasn't. Let's say a parent says, jump. I want to see you jump. I'm the parent. You jump. Keep it up, baby. You have to listen to me. Obedience for obedience sake. So that is the point. All, this whole group of Rishonim is trying to make the very profound, conceptual, philosophical point. Obedience for obedience sake is not part of Kibbutz Avayim. It's abused by parents, unfortunately. But it's not legitimately part of Kibbutz Avayim. If it's a mitzvah that the child has to do, then they have to be obedient if the parent asks for it. If the parent says, please take my clothes to the cleaners, please get me food, so that is the mitzvah of Kibbutz Avayim, to be obedient to that request. But obedience for obedience sake is not part of the mitzvah. And the Ma'arik and others who agree with him are saying, when you start getting into who you should marry, ultimately that's obedience, but nothing else. And obedience for no other reason is not part of the obligation. Now again, the obvious point notwithstanding, maybe the parents are wiser, maybe the parents are actually on to something, maybe you should... And how do you resolve this, and should you really go through with the marriage if it would completely sever a relationship with parents? Those are the things I have to meet with you in my office about. This is not for the sake of this year. I admit this is much more complicated in real life. I understand that. But in terms of what halakhic categories do and don't apply, this is very, very important to understand. And this relates to many other sources, not just to marriage, just this is where it gets fleshed out. It's an important thing, I think, for us as parents to realize. That's not what Kibbutz Avayim is about. It's not about lording over someone. It's not about having them obedient to us. It's about other things which are very powerful and potentially, unfortunately, intoxicating the parents, about honor and about service. That it is about. But it's not about obedience for obedience' sake. Yeah. You still have a question? Yeah.
Circumstances where, for example, the parent couldn't be expected to support.
I think that's completely different. That's completely different. That's completely different. Now, again, the shoe is going to be constantly on both feet. You see, I've looked at children and said, do you really want to do this? You know what your parents are going to do. I've also looked at parents and said, you know, you can take that position, but it's going to have ramifications. So again, how this gets employed in both directions, but whether parents have to support a married child is a separate question entirely. And the answer is pretty much no. So if a parent would otherwise want to do it, but then chooses not to do it because they think the child disobeyed them or is making a mistake, that probably is the parent's prerogative. Whether they would be advised to do it or not, again, that's got to be a case-by-case basis. But this is not at all, you don't get to say, I'm going to live my life the way I want it, and you're going to pay for it. I think that's obvious. Yeah?
How about the situation where the parents say, well,
very interesting. So I want to mention, I'll skip ahead for a second to Tshuva 17, the Meshiv Gavr, the Nitziv, the great Nitziv of Elajim. I don't know if this is necessarily, I'm not sure, I haven't spoken to the more modern, recent poskim, would they use this or not, this Nitziv, but what he does place a limitation on this rule that parents can't get involved. What's his limitation? If the marriage will cause bizayon to the parents. Because as we've seen it before, this a little bit relates to what Murray was asking me, but we'll see another thing that Murray's asking me in the previous 16. There's kibud avayim, there's mora, but then there are other categories. There's even where kibud or mora doesn't apply, you can't just say ridicule your parents. What category is that? That's not obviously in either of the categories. There's bizayon, ridiculing a parent, embarrassing them, is its own prohibition. To give you an illustration, we say in the Gemara, we discuss this in the Shabbos here, that parents can, and in fact the Rambam and others say, are encouraged as often as possible to be mochel on their kavod. Right? It's not the greatest relationship you can have with children if you're constantly standing on ceremony and on kavod. So parents, it's a halakhic question, are parents allowed or not? And the Gemara says, yes, parents are allowed. The halakha is also, on the one hand, that's true. On the other hand, parents are not allowed to be mochel on their bizayon. What constitutes bizayon, maybe that's subjective, but certainly one could make the argument, I've attempted to myself, because I think it's so terrible, when children call their parents by the first name. And I know of a handful of families where the parents encourage this. So they're being Michael! So if it's just a question of kavod, then maybe they have that right. But if you would argue, and I'm not doing it definitively, but I've thought about this, if that would be considered a bizayon, to call your parent by their first name, then even if the parent wants, they're not allowed. And certainly more obvious examples of really, really doing parents, even if the parents are masochists, or whatever the psychological reason are, the parents would be okay with it, it doesn't matter. It's still an aver for the child. So says the Nitziv here, maybe kibud avayim doesn't apply to getting married. Maybe mora avayim doesn't apply to marriage. But if this is a marriage that's going to humiliate the parents, why, I don't know exactly the case, then he says, well, that's the water's edge. We're going to stop there. Again, how to apply this obviously would have to be done on a case-by-case basis because it may often be just in the parent's mind. Well, they're not worth $500 million. That's a bizarre to me. Perhaps that's inappropriate, thrown around of the category. But again, that has to be taken. It really relates, though, to source number 16. And I'll just mention this briefly because it's a limitation, but it adds an important category. The Chazon Ish asks the basic question, which we're alluding to now, on this Marik. Because I don't understand. True kavod, true mora doesn't apply to picking a spouse. But since when are you allowed to cause pain to parents? And if this is going to cause pain to them, one of the halachos of mora, for example, is you can't contradict them. Lo listor es devarov. Says the Chaznish, how is this any better than that? It's at least as bad as that, if not worse. Publicly, even if it wouldn't be public, but contradicting them, they tell me to get married or not to, and so why is that allowed? That's stiras. That's at least you're being mitzar them. You're hurting your parents. Whoever gave you a right to do that, you can't be mochel on that. So this is what he says. So from a conceptual perspective, he thinks, I'm not sure he's right or not, but he does very much try to attack this maharik. But even he ultimately answers that it's still okay, or it's still okay for the child to get married. Why? So he has a classic line. If you take a look at this, again, it's verse 16, and the second to last line. He says, he thinks he wants to reread the Marik because he can't leave it as is because he has this question on him. Ikar taimo shal Marik, what is the real reason? What is satisfied the Chazon Ish? Sheha'av tzarech levatel ritzono mipnei ritzon bano. Yes, if each side are, right, if the immovable object meets the, the irresistible force, thank you, I'm glad you're here tonight. So then we have a conflict, and then the Marik says that the child wins, and the Chazon Ish is not sure why does the parent. As the Chazon Ish, I have a different solution. The immovable object should not make himself so immovable. Yes, I'm bothered, says the Chazon Ish. How could a child go through with a marriage if it's going to hurt the parent? So he doesn't have an answer for that. But he says, I'll get out of the problem anyway. The parent has to make sure that he's not going to be hurt. There's no defense for the child, in his opinion, to hurt the parent. Perhaps Marik would disagree with him, I'm not sure. But he says, there's no defense. But who gave the right to the parent to be hurt? And he gives us an analogy. If a child, let's say a child is more successful than a parent, and a child has a beautiful menorah, a beautiful tie, a beautiful blouse, and the parent wants it, and it hurts them that they don't have it, does the child have to give it to them? Because it's absurd. Of course not. Because that's the parent's neurosis. They shouldn't. I'm not going to say, but you're hurting me. But you shouldn't be hurt by that. Says the Chazal.
Earlier on, we didn't care that the parents were off the wall and they came in and slapped him in the face.
Even on those Gemaras.
Yeah.
He has to resolve those Gemaras. He discusses, he says those have to be for a good reason. They have to be productive.
Something we didn't share.
Okay. I didn't know that Chazal Nishtan. But he says something very important. And this is, again, it's certainly in the world of parenting advice. Golden. How to apply this is, again, tricky. He says, you shouldn't be... There are legitimate and illegitimate concerns for parents. Sometimes parents overstep their bounds. It's not necessarily enough for the parent to say it would hurt if you did X or Y. Because it may not be legitimate for them to be hurt. Now, who gets to decide? Sometimes me. By which I mean if sometimes parents ask me, people ask me. But, I'm acknowledging that the application of this, of course, could be tricky. But again, I'm speaking now in terms of the concept here. It's a very he introduces something very fascinating to the discussion. So we saw really some incredible ideas, which are very far-reaching, fleshed out in this otherwise important question on its own right. Can parents be involved in complicating marriage situations? So the first very fascinating new idea we saw was the idea that perhaps Kibbutz Avim is not relevant to issues which are just about obedience. That maybe it's only relevant to things which are only directly affecting them. That is a very fundamental limitation of the mitzvah of Kibbutz Avim. And that, if you accept that definition, it seems the simple understanding is that it would be true even if you hurt your parents along the way. The Chazon Ish has a wrinkle which is also very fascinating, in which he does not think you have ever a right to hurt your parents if it's really wrong what you're doing, even if they're melchol or whatever. But he says there are times where it's really the parent's fault. You know, as we would say, perhaps in another context, don't be so sensitive. Right? Someone could say the most innocent thing and you could take offense. That doesn't mean you did anything wrong. So as an analogy, that's what the Chazon Ish says here. True, the parents are getting hurt. And in theory, there's no right for a child to hurt the parents. But he says, who should give in? The parent, you know, it should never come to that. Because ultimately, the parent should say, I'm not going to be hurt. I'm just going to be happy for them. Now, again, I've been a witness, both in terms of extended family or even cousins or friends, to all sorts of unfortunate situations. I'm not always privy to every detail necessarily, but I know of plenty of cases, unfortunately, where, you know, standing from afar, one or both of these would have helped solve the problem. And sometimes people really hold it to the end. They don't come to the wedding, or they come to the wedding and can't smile. I mean, there are some unfortunate... The most extreme case I know of was when my parents were a young married couple, and there was a boy that my father went to YU with who was from a relatively prominent family, and he wanted to marry this girl from kind of the other side of the tracks. The parents were so beneath them that they not only would they not support the kids after the marriage, they didn't want to support the marriage, they wouldn't come. My parents and a few friends made a ragtag wedding on the roof of their apartment building in Teaneck for this couple. Could you imagine? So that's, you know, it's like you want this just... And the parents say, but you're hurting me. So you want to read them the Chazon Ish. You shouldn't be so... I mean, you got to learn, you got to grow up. I mean, there's no other way to say it, but there are extreme cases like that. Nebuch, yeah.
What if
someone doesn't
agree with someone that isn't religious?
That's it. I'm going to pass the buck. There are a lot of reasons why. Let me just put all what I would say as follows. There are a lot of reasons why the child should not marry that person. Agreed. What would be relevant for this year would be to ask, would Kibbutz Avim be a reason not to? And that I'm not sure that would be. There might be other reasons why the child should not do it. But I don't know if the parent says, don't marry her because I'll be upset, I don't know if that alone would be a reason. There are plenty of good reasons. Obviously, we would not be in favor of such a marriage. But whether Kibbutz Avim would be the reason, I'm not sure. For the sake of time, I just want to very quickly mention some other issues. If you take a look at the next sources here on this page, we don't have time, unfortunately, to see them inside. I hope you'll take the opportunity to take a look at them on your own. But just so you should know, this is a whole group of sources that discuss another example, which is also very fascinating and sometimes very practical, and has to do with learning, yeshiva. Parents want the child to go to this yeshiva, the child wants to go to that yeshiva. Parents want the child to stay in town, the child wants to go out of town. And we can add to multiply the level of complication. What if out of town is Israel? I didn't even put it on the sheet, but there are plenty of tshuvas about aliyah against parents' wishes. Rabbi Yosef, for example, has some recent tshuvas about that. Take a guess what he says. You get an American posting, that's a more relevant tshuva. I'm just kidding. I think the American posting might agree with him also, but be that as it may. A lot of all of these types of discussions. So it's explicitly discussed in Shulchan Aruch, where the child wants to learn in a certain yeshiva, they think they're going to do better there, and the parent does not want them to. So there's two issues that are raised here that I have on the sources, which again, I'm just letting you know. One is, if the child wants to go out of town, let's say, so it's not that there's a conflict directly about that, but if they're out of town, they won't be able to fulfill Kibbutz Avim. Who's going to be a machil or mashke? Who's going to do all those things? So about that, we rule Gadol Talmud Torah Mekibbutz Avim. It's true. If learning is going to take the child away, won't be able to do Kibbutz Avim, the learning comes first. But we point out, we specify, but whenever they're home, then of course the mitzvah does apply. It's not like all or nothing. But if it has to do with being home or not being home, again, not discussing complications, real issues. Not long ago, I was at a wedding at a shmorg, and someone from the shul spoke to me about 45 minutes, all about, not actually about, this is actually related to shidduchim, so it really got complicated. Their daughter was going to go out with a guy who had stayed extra years in yeshiva against his parents' wishes, and there was a rupture, and what does that say about the boy? What does that not say about the boy? And the truth is, sometimes, even despite this halacha, maybe it's the wrong decision of the child. This is really a topic that has to be handled on a case-by-case basis, but you will often hear, and maybe some of you have already gone through this, where if the Rebbeim are more than happy to give this Maror Malchum to the students, right? That this learning Torah comes before Kibbutz Avim. So that's true if it's not a direct conflict, it's just that it's one's going to lead to the violation or the unfulfillment of the other. Later in this verses 21 and 22 are about the more, if you will, flashy case I was alluding to, which is where the conflict is about learning. Don't go to that yeshiva. Do go to that yeshiva. So it's not a question of, the yeshiva's wonderful, but you just won't be around to help me with the groceries. It's we're fighting over the yeshiva. We're fighting over learning, and the learning, etc. And this was originally asked by one of the great German Rishonim, one of the last Rishonim, or perhaps first Achronim, depending where you draw the line, Rav Isserlein, known as the Trumas Hadashen, and he paskins, that again, details notwithstanding, Gadol Talmud Torah, the boy, in this case, is discussing, has the right to choose the yeshiva that he thinks he'll learn better in, even if the parents don't want to. And it's interesting, what is the parental objection here? Not that it's too left-wing, it's too right-wing, it's too this, it's too that. It's dangerous. It's in a town where the parent was worried about the danger of the child. You can only imagine the modern resonance to this. Right? Here they're talking about other cities in Europe, but they're not even talking about Eretz Yisrael. But that's the father again. It's a pretty legitimate concern if you're a parent. The child's not worried, I'm going to be okay, right? He's a teenager, of course he's not worried. But they're Chuma Sadeshin size of the sun. Ultimately, if the boy thinks he's going to have learn better there, the parents cannot stand in the way. And in fact, if you turn over to the last source pages on your source sheet here, there you go.
Do the parents have to finance it? If the kid says, "I really have to go to Israel for camp," and he says, "You
don't." I would say that's a case by case basis. I'm serious. I wouldn't say never, but I'd also say not always. That's on a case by case basis. I alluded to that before with Marcel. It depends. Again. If the question would be, I'm going to pay for Baltimore, but I don't want to pay for New York, let's take a simple example like that. So then I would, again, not knowing any of our imaginary details, I would be inclined to say they should pay for it. If it's a question more akin on the side of, let's say, where Marcel said, you're already at an age where we think you should be earning a living on your own because you want to learn more, we should have to pay for it. We've already done the base, and there are parental obligations for education. So the point is, if it has to do with where the education is happening, so the child may get to decide that, even though the parents still have to finance it. But if you've gotten to the point where the child certainly already learned enough that the parental obligations have been exhausted, they just want to learn even more, so then the parent may say, I want to, or the parent may say, I don't want to. And one of the many reasons why a parent may decide yes or no, maybe if they're happy with, if you live down the block from me, yes. If you want to run off to wherever, again, when the parents are within their rights, they may very well be within their rights. Again, it may depend on how extreme the case is, what the age of the child has to be, as I say. I hate to keep on talking, but I have no choice. These are too complicated to answer in a forum like this. They have to really be handled. I just want to mention, before I take a question, one last thing on this topic. In source number 23, the Pesachei Tshuva makes two important points. One is that you just shouldn't think it's always the father who's the bad guy. So he says that it's not just limited to learning also. He mentions, what if the mother, I don't know why this just happens to be the case, what if the mother doesn't want the child to daven in a certain shul? That's the case. That was the case. That was the case. Look at the underlined part of source number 23. Rosa Hilspalo based on Knesset, Shemispalo some Yoser Kavana. That's where he really wants to chuckle. Schomburg told me he can't chuckle on that. He says, okay, I'll go down the block. They chuckle like this all the time. So he says, the emo mochebeze. That was the case. The mother said, no, I want you to davening with me, daven with your father, whatever. Ein tzarach l'shma Allah. It's better for his relationship with Hashem. That comes first. That was an example. Here, the other thing he points out is, sometimes parents will say, you think you're going to learn better there. How do you know? Maybe you could learn just as better here. So he says, that doesn't matter. Even if it's, there's no guarantees in life. Even if it's a suffix, the child thinks they're going to learn better there. That itself is enough. There is a prerogative for the child to go where they're going. Now again, as I said, for each side who holds to whatever they think they have the right to do, there's almost always fallout. When parents hold to that line, there's sometimes fallout. And it's also true in the other direction. In this case I was speaking to, I alluded to before at this smorgasbord, where the child, stood on his principle, the Shulchan Aruch says, I can learn where I want. Okay, and now there's a very ruptured relationship with parents, which may or may not ever get healed. Was that the right thing to do? I'm not sure. One thing I will say, and this would be controversial if I had a group of yeshivas here, but I'll say it. One thing for sure, in my opinion, is absolutely clear. The one who should be giving advice to the boy in question is not the yeshiva where he's going to be learning. I'll repeat. That should not be the one who would be directly benefiting from the child disobeying his parents. Maybe that's the right advice, but it's a clear conflict of interest. And I've seen it, I've heard about it, and I've even seen it in my office more than once. And I say this even to my own rebbeim. They're wonderful people, but they're also people. And they all want big yeshivas, and they all want good yeshivas, and they all want bodies, and they all want smart bodies and good people. You got it. They should not be the one who's saying, but the Shulchan Aruch says. That, to me, is clear. Whether it's the right decision to go or not to go is a different question. But it should not be the Rebbe or the Rosh Hashiva who's going to be directly benefiting. That is a brief resentment, certainly on the part of the parents. It's a huge mistake. Yeah.
I have two questions. Related to the second question.
Finish in 2 minutes.
Would you say then that the parent, in line with your statement, that in some cases the parents should just say, all right, we'll let it go, would this be an instance of advising the parents to just...
be mocha.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe. Again, in theory, yeah.
And I have another question. Why are none of these poskim mentioning Chazal who take Yaakov to task?
They don't. On the contrary, they bring as a source that whatever the Midrashim are, he's never punished for it. In fact, that is the source. It is the source.
No.
I'm telling you. I'm not saying there's nothing to discuss, but I'm just letting you know they do discuss it. On the contrary, we take a look at source number 21 and 22. They mention Yaakov as a source. Let me give you the line. Give me 1 second. 1 second.
Go to 19.
Yeah, go to 19. There's more than it's in a few sources. Yalfinan me Yaakov. Shkol osan shanim shalama tar ve'ayis shem ve'eber lo nana shalehem afo pisha bitom mitzvah
keeping. Wait a minute, but what about the other side of that?
Was he ever punished for it?
He lost Jesse for all those years.
We'll talk about it after this year. I just want to finish. I only have a few minutes. With more than one person in the shul already, and it's obviously only going to get more as Kanai and our parents grow older, there are a lot of shilas that can come up as parents become more infirm. Sometimes it's specific types of infirmities which create more kind of problems, and other times it can be just general old age. So we've already alluded to, more likely than not, that's where sometimes financial obligations come in, spending money for your parents, but also sometimes very basic care and concern. At least two people who are currently sitting here have asked me, Shilas, about taking care of parents, especially in older age, bathing parents, things like that. Very, very sensitive and important Shilas. I don't have time to go through them now, but there are discussions about this. Just to give you a little bit of a sense, just so to speak, to wet your palate on the topic, in sources 24 and 26, you have opinions from Chazal that speak about bathing with parents. This isn't necessarily even talking about, even if you're both very, you know, healthy in general, to go to the, you know, in Chazal, they had public bathhouses, the Schwitz. Right, so you're the JCC, you're in the locker room, you know, can you go in there together? Obviously the point here being, we're talking about it would be undressed. So Chazal here say, for example, source number 24, if I call Adam Roketz, you could theoretically bathe with anyone, except for there's a few examples that you cannot bathe with, one of which I didn't include on the sheet, happens to be a father-in-law, but here also he says specifically, more important for us, chutz me aviv, to just be around your parent, and again, it's certainly true in the other, it's true about a mother and a daughter, and it would be especially true about a son and a mother, or a daughter and a father, but even if it's of the same sex as the father and the son, they shouldn't be undressed together, they should not bathe together. Rabbi Yehuda, however, says it depends. Rabbi Yehuda, matir ba'aviv mifnei kvod aviv. What if the child is going to be bathing the child? Take an example of an infirm child. Let's look at Rashi, he explains. So in that case, Rabbi Yehuda says, since that's being done in honor of the father to take care of them, it is permissible. Now, what's the reason, what's the problem why you shouldn't bathe with a parent? So the obvious reason is not the one that's actually stressed by Rashi, but it's true. The obvious reason is it's not bekavodik. That's probably the most articulate way I can put it. It's not bekavodik, it's just not, it's unseemly. It's a little bit, not terrible, perhaps, it's not lewd, but it's a little bit degrading. That is an issue, but there's an interesting that there's another issue as well, which is actually why this relates to other examples, and that is, as Rashi tells us here, there's an assumption that it will lead to impure thoughts. What do you mean? Because if you see your parent naked, the thought is that in some way, perhaps it's, it would be some conscious or otherwise, that will more likely remind you of, so to speak, where babies come from. No joke. Again, as opposed to perhaps seeing someone else in the bathhouse, when you see your parent, oh, that's where I came from. That's how I was made. There's a thought, again, I'm not here to evaluate psychologically how likely of a hood or not, or how conscious or subconscious it would be, but it's explicit here in Rashi, but it's, and then Rashi's not the only one. Mikosha re'uhu, v'nizkar shemisham yatsa, seeing that part of the parent's body will remind you of where you came from. No sein libu lehirhur. Now, what those thoughts would be, how lewd they would be, is a different question. But they would be, at least over the line, they would be inappropriate. So certainly, which is not our topic, gives you a sense of how sensitive we are supposed to be for tzinius. But it even shows you that that's, again, something I never would have expected. If you don't see the sources, I don't know if anyone would have imagined that that would be the problem. But that's an additional problem. So when it comes to, and with this we'll close, when it comes to certain extreme cases, and this is what I've told people, sometimes there even are heterim for father and daughter, or mother and son, but certainly even if it's talking about the same sex, the father and the son, or the daughter and her mother, so even if it's, if anyone, this is, in short, what I have told people, it's always better if someone else could do it, from the Kibbutz Avim perspective. Now, if the care won't be as good, or you can't get anybody, so maybe that's not true, but in theory, all things being equal, because of this halacha, it would be better if someone else could do it, a nurse, or a neighbor, whatever the case may be. However, if no one can, or no one can as well, which are separate but both equally important points, then it is mutter for a child to do, because that's, as the Mishnah said, that is the kavod that you're giving them, if that's to be disrespectful. However, the poskim do say, because of this other consideration, even then, as much as possible, you should work things so you don't see the private parts of your parents' body, even as you're bathing them. Even, again, I'm talking about even mother and daughter, father and son. It's obviously all the more so true if you're talking about a father and a daughter and a mother and a son. But even if it's the same sex, you should do your best not to see that part of their body. If sometimes it may be unavoidable, it may be. Again, we all know cases. There are people who have to help their parents go to the bathroom. There are cases. And again, it's obvious that as much as you're doing it from love and out of kavod, for a parent especially who's still with it, it's by definition a little bit embarrassing for them. So it's not ideal. It is not ideal. Not only halachically, it's not ideal psychologically. But there are times where it's necessary. And then it's actually an incredible act of kibbutz aim, an incredible act of love beyond what really could otherwise be expected for the children. It's a wonderful thing. I can't imagine the schar that children will get when they have to do this. But they should always remember, even as they're doing this great act of kibbutz aim, there are some very subtle halachic points that still should be sensitized to. And hopefully through that, if necessary, but they will provide the proper care. There are many, obviously, other issues that relate to caring for elderly parents. But for that, we'll either have to wait for private Shilohs or perhaps another lecture series. Yishar koach, a good vach for everyone. And thank you so much for coming. And I'll invite you on behalf of the layman upstairs and to the left for delicious, delicious food from Libby.